Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. I want to thank you for joining me on this live session tonight. Hopefully, we get a couple of callers calling in to just help me discuss this topic tonight. And if you're interested in calling in, of course, the number toll-free is 877-217-3924. I'd be more than happy to take your comments and your thoughts on what we're going to be talking about. And we're going to be talking a little bit about you know, things that we do in EMS that kind of we tend to do to maybe satisfy a, you know, paperwork that you're doing, or maybe your boss, or even the emergency room, you know, things like IVs and EKGs and stuff like that. You know, when you get to think about whether or not it's really benefiting your patient. That's going to be the main topic tonight. Before we go, though, I do want to mention sort of the extend some condolences to the family of Steve Linzer. Steve just passed away. He actually had a deadly bacterial infection that took over his body, and he wound up taking Steve. He's only 45 years old, and they're actually trying to figure out if it was from a patient that he was in contact with or not. I actually knew Steve. I wasn't good friends with him or anything like that, but I did a lot of work with him when I was an EMT in Brooklyn from Lutheran Medical Center, and also worked with him a few times as a medic there as well. So, you know, nice guy, and, you know, it's just a shame to see any of our fellow EMTs and paramedics and firefighters and police officers pass on, especially taking at a young age. And this is sort of a reminder that we have to really be aware of our BBP and aware of what we're doing with patients so that we don't expose ourselves. And, you know, maybe he unwittingly did that in some fashion and wound up getting this infection without even realizing it. So it's just such a shame to see that happen. And our condolences go out to Steve and his family through this very, very tough time. So I just want to go ahead and just mention that real quick without, you know, getting too far into the episode. The other thing I want to mention is just wondering how many of you out there actually tweet. You know, how many guys out there have a Twitter account? You know, Twitter is a very popular social media type venue. You know, a lot of people might say, well, you know, I don't really tweet that much. Who wants to hear what I have to say, you know, talk about what I had for lunch or where I am at that moment. But, you know, it can be a lot more than that. I've actually met a lot of people through Twitter with my Twitter account. I'm at EMS Safe at Twitter. You know, I've met a lot of people through Twitter and kind of get up to date a lot of times and maybe get some headlines, some news from people by using it. It's not the only thing I use for social media. I'm more into the Facebook type thing, but it does, you know, open up some possibilities to other things and information and can really be sort of that quick texting type thing to a bunch of people at one time. So I kind of like it, and it's very, very popular. And a lot of times I tell people it's not a matter of, you know, if you tweet, but it's a matter of when you're going to actually tweet. So to that end, a lot of people don't, again, they're not quite sure what they're going to tweet about. What are they going to say? What are they going to put out there in order to let people know, you know, what's going on or what they're interested in, things like that. And there's a website called StuffToTweet.com, which is a pretty cool website. It has a lot of general information and entertainment and technology and stuff like that that you can go to, and you can get these headlines and see what's popular and go ahead and tweet that in your account as well. But, you know, EMS is kind of a different animal, and we like to see what's going on in the EMS industry. So there's actually a website out there that is called EMSTweetables.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, of course. But that's a website where you can go. You can get all of the top stuff going on really in EMS, some news, jobs, the popular blog posts, podcasts like this, even product reviews. So some really cool stuff that you can tweet regarding EMS. So if you run out of stuff to tweet during the day and you know, you're kind of new to Twitter and whatever, you can always go there, pick a link, copy and paste it into your Twitter account, and you know, go ahead and tweet it off. And on top of that, there's also a little section there with, again, similar to the Stuff You Can Tweet site, where it's got some sidebars there for just general information stuff that you can go ahead and you know, get a get some basic information and basic, you know, stuff on some hot topics going on around the web and in the news and stuff like that, to tweet some general information as well. So that's also pretty cool stuff that you can access on that site also. And again, it's emstweetables.com. So go check that out, and you'll see all that, all the other stuff that's there. And the good thing about that too is you're also getting a lot of stuff going on there, where you can see a lot of popular blogs and popular podcasts, and you know, other EMS websites that maybe you don't really familiar with, you don't know about them, and you can kind of get familiar with those sites. So check that out, and you know, be sure to you know, visit those sites and get in on that. Okay, so that's it for my little plug for the evening. Again, tonight's show. You can call in if you'd like. The number is 877-217-3924. And again, the title of the show is "Did You Give Your 5 CCs of Life Today?" It's kind of a sarcastic take on, you know, sometimes you feel like all you're really doing is putting, you know, an IV into somebody, you know, when they don't really necessarily need the IV. You know, you're doing it because you're trying to satisfy some type of perception that your paperwork has to justify doing it from the patient's complaints. And I'm wondering, you know, are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for the patients, for the emergency room, your boss? You know, how is your patient really benefiting from that saline lock or from that nasal cannula even, or the EKG? So I'm wondering what you think about that. Try to chat in the chat room if you can. I don't have too much activity in the chat tonight, so try to jump in there and chat away and maybe give me some of your points of view on that. Or again, you can call in. It's 877-217-3924. So here's my thing. So what are your thoughts on doing these types of interventions? You know, is it based on, you know, basic stuff like the IVs, EKGs, finger sticks, stuff like that? You know, are you doing it because of the patient's age? Are you doing it because of their, you know, a general complaint that they might have? You know, are you doing it, you know, just because you can? You know, I'm just wondering why we're doing these interventions on some of these patients, and is it fair to the patient? I do have one caller on the line here, so I'm going to bring this person in and see if we can get their quick take on this and what their feelings are. So just hang on a sec. We'll bring those in right now. Hi, who do we have on the line tonight? Hello?
Yes, it's me, Mark.
Hey, Mark, what's going on?
Have you
been listening at all tonight?
I'm sorry?
Have you been listening at all so far, what I said?
Sure. I heard everything.
Well,
yeah.
You know, Mark, I know you're not actually on the ambulance, so I guess it might be a little tougher for you to get the angle on this. You know, just take it from your point of view. Let's say you're a patient and you got a paramedic in the back of the ambulance that's doing these interventions on you, and you're wondering why they're doing it. I mean, you know, do you think that the perception maybe from patients wondering that a paramedic's doing something to somebody just because they can?
Well, let me take it one, like, maybe even two steps further. Let me take it from perceptions of how protocols are made a little bit, and also having worked in hospitals, in acute care, of being received in hospitals. I'd be remiss sometimes on how certain protocols, like after a seizure, activity,
mm-hmm.
you know, say to do an EKG, you know. Is that questionable? Do you really have to do it? But so that's a case where, you know, you have really no choice. So you really have to do it. It could probably be argued both ways, you know.
Right, because
so
you're going by the protocol. You're going by, you know, in case the patient has another seizure, you want to have the IV in place, you know,
right,
to stop it, which is understandable. And that type of stuff I can get on board with. I mean, I've actually had many patients that are, you know, I'll go ahead and critical care them. You know, I'll put the IV in, do an EKG, basic stuff. Just because of they're very elderly and they have something going on that's kind of nondescript, maybe I'll do it if they if they have a very extensive medical history and I can't really pinpoint what's happening to them at the moment, I'll go ahead and get that started. So if something starts evolving during my patient
It
contact,
makes it much easier.
right, I've got stuff in place already and I'm kind of ready to go. But my thing is, like, when you're doing for stuff to patients that don't necessarily need it. They're the patients that the fevers, the flus, someone who just started having diarrhea that day or something, things like that, where, if something evolves with them, that they start having more diarrhea or the fever gets higher or something like that, there's nothing really in our drug box we're going to give them. There's nothing in the airway bag, nothing in the trauma bag, stuff like that, that we're really going to be able to use to counteract what's going on. We're just kind of starting that intravenous just to kind of start it, and then we're staring at them in the back of the ambulance. I'm wondering, just like, again, like, how beneficial is that, to the patient at that point, especially when you're in the back of a moving ambulance doing this type of stuff,
Yeah, that's very true. So again, like you point out one scenario, like where one is kind of justifiable, where you have a judgment call where a patient may be okay, but presents that they may potentially be unstable at one point in time. And you make a clinical decision that, you know what, why we have them maybe in their home before we get into that situation where it's going to be that rocky road. Let's, put in the saline lock and get ready. So if something happens, we have IV access. But I think when we're talking about these calls or maybe deemed called sick calls, I think from a patient's perspective, you're really putting them through a lot. I mean, then again, the other side of the argument is, they're the ones who did call 911 to begin with, but how harsh do we really go? And then now when I said we're talking about the I said from the perspective, I kind of addressed a little bit protocol, so sometimes you really have no choice. You may argue against the protocols of what's the legitimacy of really doing certain things, but it's unfortunately, it is what it is. But sometimes, depending on certain institutions where the hospital ERs are, you may know that when you go in there, nurse X or physician who's in a hospitalist or whatever type of arrangement they have, they expect you to have an IV line put in because they don't want to be bothered doing that.
Oh,
And
yeah,
if you
well,
bring it
that's
in there, there's going to be complaints to your agency, and
right.
that's where some problems
And
may
this is where,
occur.
right, this is part of my I guess pseudo argument for tonight is that, why are we doing it for the emergency room? If they have a job to do, why put the patient at risk for infection, for their comfort or discomfort, just to satisfy a nurse because a nurse is expecting you to do it because you've done it in the past. You want to spoiling them a little bit. Their expectations are higher, and then when you don't get it, even if you don't get it because of the fact that maybe it was just a bad stick, you just couldn't get the IV on this patient, and now you bring them in without the IV. They're gonna start. They get way too used to it. I mean, I've had that happen to me where I've had patients that I've brought in, and I've 99% of the time, I'm bringing them in there with IVs established and bloods drawn and stuff like that. And then the one time I couldn't get the IV, it's not that the patient needed it that much, but they're like, "Oh, no IV." And then they look at you like you have 10 heads, like you're shorting them. You're not doing them a favor. But how many times are you even going to stick a patient in the back of the ambulance? I mean, I've had partners that will sit back there and treat the patient like a pincushion just to give them that saline lock, and that's all they're getting is a saline lock. Nothing else is really going to be going on. They're just getting a saline lock, and that's it. And then you're sitting back there with them. So here you are sticking them, over and over again with a needle when you don't really need to do it. You're satisfying again. You want to satisfy that need for the. The nurse or maybe your paperwork, because again, like you said, going back to protocols where you're doing it to satisfy a protocol, and well, our hands are kind of tied when it comes to that. Those situations, it's kind of difficult to justify not doing it because then you are putting yourself at risk for QA issues and stuff like that. Mark, I think I got Josh on the line here too. I don't want to keep him on hold too long, so I know he's probably
Sure,
biting
not a problem.
his
Hi,
chomp at
Josh.
the bit to try to get in on this. Josh, are you there?
Hey, Jim, how you doing? Thanks for
how you
having
doing?
Me. Yeah, sorry, I had some technical difficulties today.
Oh, that's all right. It
My
happens.
Firefox has revolted.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Well, you know, it happens, I guess, you know.
Yeah, well,
so
it's
Josh,
all part of EMS, right?
Yeah, you know, we're just talking a little bit about kind of just bouncing it back and forth to each other on, you know, the fact of doing interventions on patients when there's not a big reason to do it, you know. And like I mentioned just before you had called in, sometimes we do it because we're kind of forced to because of protocols, you know. And there is a underlying need, you know, according to the protocols and medical directors and medical controls view that we should have, you know, an IV established or an EKG performed and things like that because of that chief complaint or that presenting problem. But what about things that I mentioned early on, you might have missed it, you know, patients that have fevers and flus and things like that, general weakness complaints, you know, where if you don't do an IV, you kind of looked like you have 10 heads by the ER when you pull in, you know, for not getting an IV established, or maybe your paperwork gets kicked back because of the fact you didn't start an intravenous on a patient, you know, that had a complaint like that. You know, do you run into that? Let me ask you this. What drives your decision-making process when you do that?
I think as you mentioned, there's two ends to this that sort of intertwine. And the first part is ours is not the reason why. Ours is just to do or die. Follow those protocols and you won't get hurt. Follow the protocols and, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. Smarter minds than you, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the patient care issue. There's the, you know, what you evaluate is really wrong. You know, does this person need this treatment in your eyes? I mean, I've put in IVs in perfectly, seemingly perfectly healthy people other than a singular complaint. Maybe it's dizziness or maybe it's something else, because I figure if it's dizziness and it's so bad that they're calling an ambulance for it, this may be the top of the iceberg and a progression may occur and that I may be the witness to that. So I want to be, you know, ready and have the things I need necessary in order to treat that patient. But on the flip side, I think we've all been in that situation where we're working with somebody who maybe doesn't know us as well or that we don't agree head-to-head on. And there are times when we look at this person, I'm not going to stick them. You know, we're 10 minutes away. They'll do fine until we get there. There's no reason for this. And you get looked at when they say, well, the protocol says, and you're like, at that point, what do you say?
Well, you know, the thing, like even like you just mentioned, like a dizziness type of a call. I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying. I might do the same type of thing for patients, but I might base it more on, I mentioned earlier, maybe a patient that's very elderly or has a significant medical history. I might go ahead and you know, drop a line in, do an EKG and stuff like that for those patients, you know, because of that. But
right.
You know, the thing is, though, like for a patient like that, there's not really a dizzy protocol. You know, there's nothing in the drug box that we have that's going to fix them. You know, nothing in the trauma bag or anything like that that's going to help them with their dizziness. But yet we're sticking them with a needle. We're exposing them to infection. I mean, let's face it, it's not as sterile in the back of a moving ambulance as it is, you know, in an emergency room. You know, not that that's going to be that sterile either, but it's a hell of a lot more sterile
right.
than, you know, in a not that well-lit, you know, apartment or the, again, a moving ambulance and stuff like that. So that kind of is my main take on it.
Well, you're 100%. You're on the mark. I mean, it is that ever ensuing argument. What should you do for the patient? Is it your judgment, or is it some judgment that was written by a committee of people who know a lot, who understand majority of the medical conditions, but have made this broad group of operations that we're supposed to do in order to ensure that a patient's healthy, or that ensure a patient is cared for as a level of standard of care.
Yeah.
And you're stuck. I personally think that for a lot of things, you could look at this guy, there could be no reason in the world that you think anything needs to be done, and you still have to go through 20 minutes of workup because if you don't, you're going to be the one that's going to fail.
Yeah, I mean, just look at your chest pain type calls where you get, people call for chest pain regular basis. It's just something that's said to them that, in my opinion, sometimes dispatchers coach them to admit they're having some type of a chest discomfort. Oh, you're having chest pain? Oh, yeah, I'm having chest pain too. And then you get there and you figure out, okay, well, it's not really cardiac related chest pain. It's probably musculoskeletal. It's probably something else. And you don't treat it with nitro. And now, you've got to worry about everyone questioning you, not treating you with nitro and aspirin and doing a 12 lead and the whole gamut, because, your perception of what the patient actually was having. But they're expecting you to do it because of the call type.
Right.
And not necessarily and because of the chief complaint and not necessarily because of your clinical impression and what you did during your evaluation.
I'll give you the classic what do I do scenario. And a 17-year-old girl falls within the adult protocols, is sitting there. She cries. Her friends call up 911 or whatnot. She broke up with her boyfriend, and she's been crying a lot, and her chest hurts. Why don't we even add into that a little bit of blood-tinged sputum because she's been crying so forcefully and so much that she's irritated her airway and she's actually kicking up a tiny bit of blood.
Yeah, she's been coughing.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So let's put that complication in, right in. How are you going to treat that patient? We all know how we're going to want to treat that patient, okay? And I won't make anybody say it on the air in a recording. But how are you going to treat that patient?
I'm going to give her a pillow.
a big huggy bear.
I'm going to give her a pillow. She can cry into the pillow.
Right.
Well, one thing with those type of patients, I will say you have to kind of look out for, if you look at some of the stuff out there, they do tell you be wary of just blowing off patients like that as just being, the hysterical, the hyperventilation type patient type stuff. But 98% of the time, or probably even higher than that, that's just what it is. It's someone who's having an hysterical event. They're upset. They're having an anxiety attack over an emotional event in their life.
Well, I'm going to put this caution in. I'm going to throw this in. It's like at those cautions there for a reason, and they're real good. But the truth of the matter is what are those cautions about? Using your judgment. Okay,
right.
You're presented with this female, 17 years old, HYS. All of this stuff is happening that we described. They called 911. Now it's time for you to use your clinical skills. Be a clinician and dig down and try to establish what's the root cause of what's going on. Has she been a drug abuser? Has she been overactive with caffeine? Has she had any bouts that were similar in the past? Is there anything abnormal about the day, or was this pretty much as it is? Instead of when you hear the hoof prints, are you thinking really horses or are you looking for zebras?
Yeah.
So, that, just to throw that back at you.
Good, Mark.
I think if I could interject, I think really the key is of all this is that when you go out there and there's not a clear protocol or anything, and then everything is sort of a juxtaposition in terms of how it's called out there when it's dispatched as, chest pain, and when you go out there and you do your assessment and you find out that, you rule it out and you find out in this scenario that Josh was presented to us, if it's ever going to go up, which is the focus of a lot of this podcast about CYA, it's always good documentation to have on your, whatever it's PCR, ACR, to make sure that it's there. So that if it's ever questioned, you may not have a recollection. Something may come up later on or whether it's through some type of legal type of case, or whether they're just going through randomly and they want to just bring you up and say, you know, why was that your choice of treatment and action plan at that point in time? And then this way it is. Now, again, why we're talking about it is, you know, then we're getting kind of bottled down and doing a lot of the paperwork and taking away that patient care. But unfortunately, this is everything even that I do as a pharmacist all the time, always having to document, because if you didn't document it, it unfortunately didn't happen. So it's,
well, yeah,
no,
you know, the
clear-cut
thing,
policies.
Thing that I'm thinking about, though, is, you know, if you're doing stuff to I mean, sometimes it's easier to just go ahead and do stuff because it's going to cover your butt, right? It's easy just to do it, document that you did it, and it helps cover your butt on that end. But at the same time, if you don't do it, and it, that should still fall back on your documentation, where you're documenting why you didn't do it. If you get a chest pain patient, you know, that seems what we're focusing on right now. But it'll take a chest pain patient. If you get those patients and you don't do the IV, the lock, you don't do the nitro, stuff like that, you have to be able to document in the paperwork why you didn't do it, why you felt it wasn't a cardiac-related call. And you have to stand by that. I mean, that's a big thing that I'm big on is, you know, is as paramedics, and if we want to be, you know, clinicians out there in the field, not be the cookbook type provider that just follow a step-by-step, you know, piece of paper on how to treat a patient, we have to be able to stand by our clinical assessments and stand by what we're doing and document appropriately and be able to stand by that. You know, we shouldn't be just be doing – I don't think we should just be, you know, doing stuff to patients to necessarily cover ourselves, you know, just to do it. You know what I mean? That's my main thing. Because I think it that's going to lead to, like we said earlier – you know, where you start spoiling emergency room nurses and it's expected, and then you wind up setting that precedence that, you know, everybody gets in that back of that ambulance and starts getting, you know, gets the workup.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt, and I agree with you 100%, Jim, that there's the aspect of that line of where do we draw that between being a clinician and being sensible for what we're being faced with in the back. And, you know, I think the answer, you know, you sort of started out this whole topic of is this treatment or CYA? And I think, unfortunately, right now, where we are, it's CYA. I mean,
yeah.
Look, in as clinicians, and if you have respect yourself in the field, doing what you're doing, you know, you keep up with the trends, you keep up on the things you're supposed to be doing, and you respect yourself as a clinician. You want to do the best for your patient. You're not there for any other reason. You know, you're going to try to do the best for the patient, but there's going to be a point when you're going to get, you know, the intox or something else, and you're going to say, listen, I could drop a line. I mean, truthfully, I mean, when you have a student on board, who's the one dropping the line on the intox?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, there are intoxes that I will start an IV on and start getting, you know, I'll hang a big bag of fluid on them and get that going, but it depends upon how intoxicated they are. I mean, if they're sitting there fighting me, I'm not going to put myself at risk either for, you know, getting a needle stick with somebody that's fighting me. Yeah, it's just because they decide to drink too much that day.
Right.
You know, I mean, I tell you, when I first became a medic, you know, you get a lot of just breather calls, and you get there, and it's pneumonia, and you're like, oh, my God, what am I supposed to do for pneumonia? There's no protocol for pneumonia, you know. And then I took a CME shortly after that, and, you know, I had the doc in front saying, he said, listen, if you get a patient that's got pneumonia, start the line, give him some, you know, hang a bag of fluid. Because when you think about it, you know, all the moisture they're blowing off from breathing, you know, they can wind up getting dehydrated from having the pneumonia.
Right.
So while there's not a protocol involved, you know, I even now I'll have people, you know, other fellow medics that I know that will, you know, kind of gripe that it's a pneumonia call. What am I supposed to do for that? And I tell them, well, if you think about it, you know, they can be getting dehydrated from that. And at the minimum, at least what we can do for them is you know, hang some fluid and start an IV. And yeah, it's not a protocol. You're not going to overload them with fluid, but you get that stuff going. You get it started. You know, you might be surprised that it might have some benefit to them before, you know, you arrive at the hospital, depending upon your ETA, you know.
You know, I attended a very similar lecture, and I have a number of medics that I work with who feel exactly the same way. And when we come across somebody who's really junky, really bad chest sounds and everything else, and they're not doing great, you hang a bag. And you may, you know, you KVO it. We're not looking to rehydrate them, but we're looking to, you know, keep access and maybe give a little fluid in the process, since KVO is a little bit inaccurate as it goes.
Right, exactly. And the thing is, it's like, you know, that's the type of thing where, you know, you can start making the difference. You can start being part of their you know, their health care, if you will. You know what I mean? And you know, some dog, you get, like I said, you get, oh, it's bronchi. I have nothing I can give for bronchi. I don't have antibiotics. I can't do anything for that. You know, but you know what? You know, sometimes if they're really junky, you can call a doc, and they might give you an EB treatment to give on the way to the hospital. You never know. You know what I'm saying? So it depends upon how far you want to take it. I mean, there's two sides of this, I guess. One side is, okay, are we doing it just to cover our butts and doing it for patients, again, that maybe just have a fever or they have a flu or, you know, generalized weakness type stuff, as opposed to doing it because of our clinical impression, our clinical decision-making process on what a patient might need as far as treatment goes. And whether it's just nasal cannula or whether it's all the way up to, you know, doing maybe a diagnostic 12 lead to get a better idea of what's happening with them along that line, you know, it really should be up to, I think, the provider. I'm saying if someone is not in a protocol to do it, if it's something that's not necessarily in a written protocol, then I think that judgment winds up being left up to the provider, and we have to, I think, should live and die by our clinical decisions and what we decide we should be doing for a patient, not doing for a patient.
You bring up an excellent, excellent point, Jim, and that is on the CYA, then using your provider impression on a modality for treatment. And it's simple as this. If you're a cookbook medic and you just do things to CYA, well, you know what? You just missed an opportunity to make somebody better, because you in that diff breather that was, you know, bronchi and a URI, upper airway infection, upper respiratory infection, you've now not treated them. You're now not giving them, you're now not doing anything to help them, you know, get along. And you want to know something? Here's what lies in your lap, depending on your transport times. If that situation, you've come really at the crux of the situation and it's about to get worse on you, now you can have a person that deteriorates in the back of your bus instead of maintains.
And that goes too to the emergency room, because that's when the emergency room looks at you like, okay, they're not looking at you as, okay, you know what, I'm spoiled, this medic always gets me an IV. Now they're looking at you like, okay, you know what, this medic's lazy. He could have done an IV for this patient. They really could have benefited from a little bit of fluid. They could have benefited from some oxygen or whatever, or maybe benefited even from an EKG to give me an idea of what's happening when they come in. For this type of a patient, now you kind of look like a lazy provider, and the provider is just doing, like you said, just being that cookbook type of a medic, just following protocols and not thinking about a clinical impression of the patient. The last thing I just want to touch on tonight, and it goes along with this, and I actually read a blog post recently about this as well. It's about informed consent. You know, what about these patients, again, the ones that don't necessarily need the IV, and here we are doing it, CYA. Are we informing these patients as to why we're doing it? I mean, we're not giving them any medication. They're sitting there looking at us, sticking them with a needle in the back of a moving vehicle, and they're wondering, why the hell is this person, this ambulance driver, you know, sticking me with a needle back here? You know, are we giving these people informed consent? Are we giving them the option to, you know, refuse or not want to get stuck with a needle?
My opinion on that one is I sort of always give informed consent, because you're not under the dictionary term. I don't know if we ever do. I mean, you know, do you explain to somebody who's in respiratory failure, you're about to intubate them and all the complications that can arise from that, at least in the bottom line? I think that's been eliminated from our our requirements in the essence that we're being called in an emergency and we have certain autonomy to use our clinical skills to make an impression and then treat upon that impression. And then what, you know, so in the sense of dropping an IV and saying, you know, have I clinically informed this person of all the risks, et cetera, of infection and all those other things, you're saying no. So you say, listen, I'd like to start an IV on you. It could cause a little bit of pain, a little bit of discomfort, but it'll give me the access that I think I may need. If you really don't want it, you can tell me you don't want it. And,
right.
You know, and it's interesting that in certain instances when we do that, we sometimes leave out if you really don't want it, you know, you don't have to have it. But
right.
I tried to start an IV on a chest pain patient, and they said, I don't want AIVs. I don't want you touching me.
Oh, yeah,
me.
You get those patients who don't want anything from you.
Right.
They don't want drugs. They just want that ride to the hospital.
Just
you
be
know.
A driver. Drive me to the
right.
hospital.
Exactly.
Right.
So you sit back, you wait for them to go unconscious, and then you can do what you want to do. But, you know. But,
right.
You know, I think, you know, and like you said, it's the informed consent part of it. I mean, I always try to tell people what I'm doing as I'm doing it. Yeah, even if it's just giving them oxygen, I always try to tell them what I'm doing. But I don't sit there, you know, and I'll be honest, I don't explain every single risk that's involved with starting an IV. I'm not going to tell, oh, you know, the catheter could shear or you might get an infection. I'm not telling them all that stuff. I'm telling them why I want to do it. You know, sometimes I just tell them, you know, listen, I want to start an IV. It makes it easier for the hospital when we get there. It's going to speed things up a little bit. And sometimes that's all they need to hear, and they're happy with it. Other times they'd be like, well, I'd rather the hospital do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I wonder how many people actually do that, or even just give them that vague chance to refuse just because they want to do it, because it's going to cover their butt in the process. It's going to make the documentation look better, and it's going to follow whatever protocol that's going to be in there. You know, patients don't want to hear, well, I'm following a protocol. You know, it's not fair to the patient either. They just say, well, I'm just going to follow A, B, C, D. I'm up to D now, so give me your arm. I'm going to do D, and I'm not going to give you anything except for this needle stick and, you know, 5 cc's of saline that's not going to do anything for you, but it's going to make me look good, you know.
You mean the special headache relief liquid that you're
right.
going to inject in
exactly.
them now?
The five, I'm going to get T-shirts made up that says saving lives 5 cc's at a time.
It's, I like it.
You know. Well, listen, we're almost out of time, guys, so I don't want to go on get too much into the topic and then run hit the wall again. I've been hitting the wall a lot lately on the show. So
yes.
any final thoughts at all, Mark, before we cut out?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely very beneficial, and it's probably not usual practice to really give some type of explanations to the patients so that they could refuse whatever it is. Also, I think that in sort of sliding towards the EDs, they are very hectic places. I know it is probably more of a somewhat sterile environment, although there's a lot of opportunistic infections there, and it's
sure.
a little more easier for those hard sticks. I'm probably a little bit against, and I don't think in New York we're doing too much of that, of doing the blood draws and then getting the coats. I think that's really catering for the institutions. But then again, there's a lot of things that go on, and it depends on what agency you work for. If you're with a private ambulance agency that has a contract with a hospital, a lot of times that could also influence what you have to do. And I think, unfortunately, even what's going on in medicine, nursing, and in my profession as pharmacy, I'm always found, you know, CYA, unfortunately. And mine, I have a little more latitude because it's not like a paramedic or an EMT that you're working under license or some other thing where there's protocol cookbooks. And I think it many years ago when I talked to old medics and old EMTs, things have changed a lot. You're really more technicians by the actual name than you are before, when it was more of a diagnostician where you were able to do a lot more things. And I hope that with this evolution of the white paper that we discussed and things, you know, will change a little bit more standardization and more opportunity to empower the medics to do a little more things. But I think the pneumonias and all those things were excellent examples and stuff that Josh talked about. It was, you know, very informative for the listeners.
Okay. What about you, Josh? Any final thoughts before we head on out?
You know what? I think that if any of the emergency field practitioners out there listening to this, unfortunately, this is just a discussion. It's not a suggestion on what you should be doing. As we leave the classroom environment and enter the field, we're always told CYA. When we're in the field, we're always told CYA. I think that aspect of our profession is still there, ever present, and needs to be paid attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, guys, thanks a lot. I appreciate you calling in and taking part tonight as usual. I'll put whatever links below in the show notes as always. So thanks again for joining. And again, you made a good point. You know, this podcast and pretty much any podcast you can listen to out there, guys, it's a thought process, a discussion. They're meant to, you know, kind of provoke some more thought on your end as a listener to, you know, whether it's going to be change the situation and the industry that we're in, or to even provide better patient care in the long run, and get your thoughts, you know, your thoughts going, your juices flowing on what you're doing for patients. So just keep that in mind. But of course, always follow your local protocols when it comes to you know, patient care and treatment. I don't want you not doing something and saying that, you know, the EMS office I was told not to do an IV because you're not doing anything for the patient. So follow your local protocol, that as always. Good night, guys. I really appreciate you calling in. Maybe we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Jim. Hey, good talking with you, Mark.
Yes, likewise, Josh. Bye-bye.
Good night. Well, guys, again, we're all out of time. Thanks for joining me, for listening live. We didn't get too much going on in the chat room tonight, but I appreciate you listening live. You listened to a recorded version. Again, thanks for taking the time to listen. And you know what? I always want to say this, you know, just to remember that EMS Office Hours is dedicated to you, the EMS professional. So, you know, I want to talk about what you're thinking regarding the EMS industry. So be sure to comment on the show over in the blog at emsofficehours.com, or just send me your thoughts and ideas to jhoffman@ems-safety.com, and I'll try to get it into an upcoming show. That's it for tonight. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. As always, stay safe.